is talk about Neoplatonism, you know, which ties in with Gnosticism to the extent that it has the same basic scheme, you could say. I wrote my dissertation on Plotinus, who was the big man in Neoplatonism, so that... Plotinus. I wrote my dissertation on Plotinus, who was pretty well, you know, the major figure in the history of Neoplatonism. He pretty well created Neoplatonism. So that I've done a little thinking about it. I'll tell you how I came to Neoplatonism, how I came to do my dissertation on Plotinus. I think it ties in with what we're talking about. When I was at college, one of my professors was Dr. Renner at Calvin College, and he was the one who got me sold on this idea of the cosmic redemption of Christ and on the calling of Christians to do scholarly work in a Christian way. So I asked him, I said, well, how best could I, you know, devote my life to Christian scholarship? Well, he says, you've got a talent for languages, you're taking a Greek major, and you've got an interest in philosophy. What I would say is the best thing for you to do is to make a study of patristics, because patristics is where it's at. Archie will bear me out here. If we have a good understanding, you know, as Christians today, what happened in patristics, we're going to get a very clear insight into very much of the history of theology and of contemporary theology. So I went to the Free University and I studied the history of philosophy with emphasis on the Greek period, and within that, with emphasis on the patristic period. And I said to myself, if I want to have a philosophical degree, if I want to have a degree, a doctor's degree, which will be accepted outside of the Christian community as being philosophically respectable, I'm going to have to take not one of the church fathers itself, but a Greek philosopher who had great influence on the patristic field. And I decided to take Plotinus, because Plotinus is perhaps the single philosopher who's had the greatest influence on patristic thought, and who therefore, an understanding of whom is quite important for an understanding of patristic thought. Now, I've tried to illustrate that in this little scheme I have. This is a very rough and ready thumbnail kind of a sketch of the history of philosophy. I'll just go through it basically, Greek philosophy, that is. I'll just go, let's see, you people there can't see it. I'll move this back a bit. Wait a minute, this thing is as shaky as can be. Oh, can you? Okay. See, basically, the way you can picture in a very rough and ready way the history of Greek philosophy through the patristic age is like this. You say, this is where the Christian era begins, right? You take 3 centuries back, and then you take 2 centuries there, and you have the classical era of Greek philosophy. That's basically Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Pre-Socratics are up here, and the Hellenistic philosophies are behind there. So, 3 centuries back, and then the 2 centuries. That's the classical period, you know, where Greek philosophy came to its full flowering and came to its, its major expression. To this day, most books on the history of Greek philosophy, you know, deal 90% with this period, and all the rest is dealt with in a final chapter called Post-Aristotelian Philosophy. On the other hand, you can do the same thing on the other side of the time scheme. You can take 3 centuries after Christ and take the 2 centuries after that, and you have there the golden age of patristic philosophy or theology or patristic thinking, the golden age of the intellectual endeavor in those days. So, you can see the importance of Plotinus. Plotinus stands on the threshold of the golden age of patristic philosophy. That's the reason I picked Plotinus as the subject of my dissertation, so that I would have a good orientation to start out. I'm only beginning to start out with a study of patristic thought. Okay. So that's a basic thumbnail sketch for, you know, it's kind of a mnemonic device to remember where you're at. Now, what I want to say about Plotinus, in the first instance, is that he recapitulates all of Greek philosophy until his day. After you had the big names in classical Greek philosophy, every one of those philosophers, the major philosophers, started a school. Plato started the Academy, and this was a school from generation to generation. This Platonic school kept on. Aristotle started the Lyceum, the Peripatetic philosophers, the Aristotelians, started a school right down the history. And a fellow who is actually just a bit after the classical period, a fellow by the name of Zeno of Citium, started a school of Stoicism, which was also a regular school right down the Hellenistic period. So pretty well the history of post-Aristotelian philosophy until Plotinus is the history of these three schools. I mean, this is an oversimplification, but it's basically what happens. An illustration of that is a famous work by Cicero, which some of you may have had to read, called On the Nature of the Gods, in which he has a survey of all the current theories of what the gods are, and then he has, in order, he has a Platonist talk about the Platonic, the academic view of the gods, and he has a Peripatetic, an Aristotelian, and he has a Stoic, and that pretty well surveys what that period of history had to say about any particular question, once you had the views of those three schools. Okay, now what I'm saying is that Plotinus, who's known as a Neoplatonist, was not only a Neoplatonist, he was also a Neo-Aristotelian and he was a Neo-Stoic. He took all those traditions right through the history of Hellenistic philosophy and more or less fused them into one grand, all-encompassing scheme, which we know as Neoplatonism. The reason that it's called Neoplatonism rather than Neo-Aristotelianism is that he took the certain passages, chiefly the myths, certain passages in the dialogues of Plato and treated them as more or less canonical. And he tried to justify all his theories in terms of the texts of Plato. He considered Plato to be the authority. But in fact, he built in all kinds of Aristotelian doctrines like Aristotelian logic, the Aristotelian idea of the thinking of the thinking, and also very many Stoic doctrines, like the doctrine that nothing should really affect a man. You know, he may be in pain, but it doesn't really affect him if he's a true philosopher. Or the idea of this seminal reasons, that the structure of things is really a logos, which is a rational thing, which derives from a higher kind of rationality. Anyhow, there's all kinds of studies which demonstrate that Plotinus was absolutely soaked through, so to speak, with all the philosophical tradition known in his day, and that he fused them together into one mighty system. And this was so impressive, this system, that all the other schools after Plotinus withered. The Stoic school pretty well died, you know, within half a century of Plotinus. The Aristotelian school pretty well died. The traditional academic school withered and died. And by the time that a century was over, the only kind of pagan philosophy that was around was Neoplatonism, Plotinus's recapitulation of the history of Greek philosophy. And you can see how important that is, because that great assimilation of the whole Greek tradition comes at a point just before the grand flowering of patristic philosophy, so that you can say, in effect, that Greek philosophy, as the church fathers, the great church fathers, some exceptions, the great church fathers knew it, Greek philosophy, as the great patristic thinkers knew it, was Neoplatonism. So that when you study the great systems of the Golden Age, you will find time and again that there are actual quotes, you know, just taken directly from Plotinus in their writings, in which they apply to their Christian doctrines. I'll, in a minute, I'll talk to you about an Augustine. about Augustine as an illustration of this. Let's see. Maybe I should go right into Augustine. Oh, right, no. No, I'll first tell you, see, I made the qualification that not all the great patristic thinkers had this. There is one especial, one exception, that is Origen. But he, too, can be tied in immediately with Neoplatonism, and I'll tell you how it goes. We have a biography of Plotinus, written by his student Porphyry, in which he tells us that Plotinus, at the age of 28, Plotinus was from Egypt, at the age of 28, was in Alexandria, and he became converted to philosophy. Now, that may seem strange to you, but in those days, philosophy was a way of life. It was like dropping out of society today. It was like, you know, joining a different culture. You dressed differently. You had a beard and a staff and a particular kind of coat that you wore. It was a completely different lifestyle. And to turn to philosophy, to start studying philosophy, was much more than just taking up another line of inquiry. It actually meant that your whole life changed. And you went around preaching the gospel of philosophy. Okay, at the age of 28, Porphyry tells us, Plotinus was converted to philosophy and started to attend the lectures of various philosophy profs in Alexandria. Now, Alexandria, as you know, is at the mouth of the Nile in Egypt, and was at that time one of the great cultural centers of the Hellenistic world. In fact, it measured up to Rome in importance. And another significant thing about it was that it had a Jewish quarter. About a quarter of the city was the Jewish quarter, and it produced many first-rate Jewish scholars, among whom are Josephus and Philo and a number of other men. So that Plotinus came to philosophy in this great cultural center and went to all the standard philosophy teachers, which meant that he would go, you know, to a representative of the Academy and of the Lyceum and of the Stoa, the Stoic. And Porphyry tells us that he was not satisfied with any of them, until a friend of his took him to a fellow whose name was Ammonius Saccas. Ammonius Saccas. And when he heard him, when Plotinus heard this fellow, he said, "This is the man I've been looking for. Touton et zeitun. This is the man I've been looking for." And he stayed with him for 11 years, studied under him for 11 years. And after that, he moved to Rome and started his own school. Now, the way this ties in with Origen is this way, that Origen Ammonius Saccas had had another student about a generation, about some 20 years, before he had Plotinus. In fact, he had had several other students. One of these students was Origen, who was the leader of the Christian catechetical school in Alexandria. At that time, there was only one school, Christian school of higher learning in the whole world, and it was in Alexandria, and a particularly bright lad by the name of Origen was the head of it, and he got his philosophical training from Ammonius Saccas. One of the reasons, perhaps, this is speculation, that he chose Ammonius Saccas is that Ammonius had himself, according to Eusebius, the Greek church historian, been a Christian, had grown up a Christian, but had thrown it overboard. But nevertheless, it's possible that Origen thought, well, at least he's close enough to the Christian faith that I can learn a lot from him. But in any case, Origen, not only Origen, but after Origen was kicked out by the local bishop, banished, the fellow who took over the catechetical school after Origen, a man by the name of Heraclas, was also a student of this Ammonius, and he, in fact, Eusebius tells us, went so far as to, even when he was a prof in this Christian school, to wear this dress, this distinctive dress of the pagan philosopher. So, that it is, we can probably deduce, see, nothing that Ammonius wrote has been preserved. So we don't know exactly what he taught, but we can more or less deduce some of the things that he said by comparing the doctrine of Origen, you know, whose writings have been largely preserved, and the doctrine of Plotinus, whose Enneads have been luckily completely preserved. So that it is in a sense true that the father of Neoplatonism is Ammonius Saccas, and that his two big pupils were Plotinus and Origen, and that so that in that sense, Origen, who is the great theologian before the great flowering, the great patristic flowering in the 4th and 5th centuries, was also influenced by Neoplatonism. My point being that an understanding of Neoplatonism is essential for an understanding of patristic thought. Okay, now I'll just tell you in very brief outline what Plotinus said. And you'll notice as I go along that this bears many resemblances to Gnosticism. He said that on top of the metaphysical ladder, that is to say, that the ultimate reality, the origin, the arche of everything that is something which he called Tohen, the One. Sometimes he called it the One. Sometimes he called it the Good. Sometimes he called it the arche. He used a lot of names for it. But every time that he would use a name like that, he would immediately qualify a statement and say, well, that is only, you know, I can only talk about that analogically. I can't really say positively that it is that. I can only say it is not diversity. You know, therefore, you know, the other side of the coin of that is really, I'd have to say it is the One, but it's, you know, it's no kind of one that we know in the cosmos that we live in. Or it is in no sense evil, and therefore the other side of the coin would be to say it is the Good, but that doesn't mean, you know, that it's the Good in any sense that we know it. It transcends all the categories of our thinking. So this One, let's just call it the One, stands above everything, is the origin of everything, and devolves, as in Gnosticism, out of itself the nous, which is a Greek word for intellect or mind or spirit, however you want to translate it. Nous, let's say intellect. And this is, the nous was for Plotinus the ultimate rationality of everything conceived as the union of subject and object. Now, I don't know if that means anything to you. You people probably know about the ideas of Plato. Plato had the notion of ideas, which were archetypes, models, patterns out in an intelligible world, which were the explanation of the individual things in the sensible world. You know, he would say, well, we see horses, all kinds of horses in the sensible world. Well, there's an idea of the horse itself, which is in the intelligible world. Well, Plotinus took over this idea, mixed it, brought it together with Aristotle's notion of thinking which thinks itself, and came up with his idea of the intellect, which is the second level of reality after the One. It's a very abstract metaphysical theory, so I probably have made it very clear, but we'll leave it at that. So he has the intellect, the nous, after the One, and the nous in turn devolves out of itself the psyche, the soul. And what the Greeks meant by the soul was essentially, or very often what they meant, was the vitality of things. And everything that has soul lives. And this soul accounted for the both in the macrocosm, the whole universe had a soul, the world's soul, accounted for the orderliness of the stars, you know, the orbits of the stars, and, you know, the change of the seasons, all the orderliness of the world at large, of the universe, was explained by soul, and also soul explained the organic order of animals and men. Okay, so that's the third stage. You have the one, you have the intellect, then you have the soul. And then you get a critical point because the soul admits evil into the cosmos. It falls. There's a kind of a fall into sin, just as we had in Gnosticism. And through this fall, we get the material world. Matter, which is, it's not really like the way we talk about matter. It was kind of like a limiting concept. It was kind of the absence. What he meant by matter was sort of the absence of order. Soul gave order, and matter was the absence of order, and was therefore intrinsically evil. And he said the principle of evil is matter. So you can see again where there's the analogy with the Gnostic notion that the material universe is in itself evil. So that is the downward progression, down from the one to intellect, to soul, to matter. But there's also a progression, a movement going up, which you have in human beings. Human beings are a composite of all these various levels. I mean, the way we are now today, like sitting in this room, you know, having relating to the material world the way we do through our senses, thinking in our soul, the way we are now is a composite, a putting together of all these various elements of matter, that's our body, of soul, that's our vitality, of our higher soul, which is in contact with the intellect, that's our thinking. And if we really get up there to theoretical abstract thought, then we're actually participating in the intellect. And, now this is essential, if we really philosophically follow this way upward and get to theoretical thought, then there's one last step, and then you become identified with the One, mystical union with the One. So that is analogous with the Gnostic notion of the reintegration into the original Godhead. So basically you have this going out of God into the whole material cosmos, and then man being part and parcel of that cosmos, but man through his soul having the capacity of coming back into mystical union with the One, which is the meaning of life. This is what men are there for. I mean, this is the only way that you can get at the good. You know, the good means pretty well the meaning of things, the point that you're here. So that man, every man, to get to meaning, to get to meaningfulness in his life, has to be a philosopher in order to get to this high, you know, this intellectual niveau of abstraction in order, in turn, to come to mystical union with the One. And this involved a lot of things. It involved a whole ethics, you know, an ascetic ethics, meaning that you stayed clear of all material things and withdrew within yourself and meditated. And there's a famous statement by his biography, Porphyry, that Plotinus was like a man who was ashamed of his body. You have that same idea as in Gnosticism, that there's this spark in man which doesn't really belong in the bodiliness of the world as we know it. Okay, so that's in basic outline what he said, with this very heavy emphasis on return to a mystical God, or, you know, first principle, and emphasis on the intellectual and the non-material. Okay. Now, I'd like to take as an illustration of his influence Augustine. Now, as you people know, the patristic thinkers can be divided very roughly, it's kind of an external criterion, but it makes sense, it has use, to divide the patristic thinkers into the Greek and the Latin fathers. The reason why it's important to make this distinction is that the tradition in which we stand is the tradition which goes back to this patristic period via the Middle Ages, or via the Western European Middle Ages. And in the Middle Ages in Western Europe, people didn't read Greek, so that much of the patristic fathers, patristic thought, was lost. Their influence was lost during the medieval period, and the people, the fathers which they read in the Middle Ages, people like Aquinas, for instance, were the Latin fathers, or those few Greek fathers which have been translated into Latin. We'll get into that in a minute. So, it's the Latin fathers which are particularly important for the tradition in which we stand. The other great Christian tradition is the one which goes, you know, through the Greek Middle Ages, the Byzantine area, and which ends up what today is the Greek Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, this whole thing with which we have little contact, although perhaps contact is growing. And we can't understand them unless we know the Greek fathers. But anyhow, so what I want to say is that for us, the most important fathers, or the immediately most important, are the Latin ones, and the greatest of the Latin fathers is Augustine. The first father was Tertullian, but he had no influence because he was basically influenced by Stoicism, and Stoicism was swamped by Neoplatonism, so that he just had no. Besides, he went Montanist, he became a heretic, so... So Tertullian, although he was a great theologian and, you know, did have a hand in the formulation of many doctrines, as a whole, had very little influence because he was basically oriented to Stoicism. He talked about the soul as being basically material, the way the Stoics had. And he's therefore not as important, you know, in terms of influence as Augustine. And there were, of course, many other... Latin fathers, Jerome, for instance, Ambrose. Let's see, there's some more. But anyhow, Augustine towers above all of them. The whole Middle Ages is dominated by Augustine. Okay, I'll tell you something about Augustine in relationship to Plotinus. I may be going over things that you've already told them, but... Okay. Augustine was born in North Africa, near what was then called Carthage, which is in what is today known as Tunisia, Tunis. His mother was a Christian, his father was not. His father was a civil servant in that African province, Roman African province. And he grew up, he was taught by his mother the Christian faith. And he was a very bright lad, and at a very early age, he threw over the Christian faith and went into the study of Latin literature. You should realize that at this time, besides the Berber language which was spoken in North Africa, the educated language was Latin, so that the tongue in which Augustine felt most comfortable was Latin, although there's evidence that he also knew this Berber language. And he had a great deal of trouble with Greek, he tells us in his confessions. He never really got to learn Greek that well. But since his great gift was in language, in the use of language, in the use of his Latin language, he went into what we today perhaps would call an English major. He became what was then known as a rhetor, which meant that you were a teacher of rhetoric, which meant that you... taught people how to speak effectively in Latin. He went from North Africa, which was his home, to Rome to exercise his profession as rhetor. And there he fell in, having lost the Christian faith, with the Manichaeans. And the Manichaeans was a Gnostic sect which put the very heavy emphasis on the devaluation of the of creation and of the material. Then he went up to Milan, which is in the north of Italy, and I've forgotten exactly through what agency or what means, he got to hear the sermons of the bishop, the chief Christian preacher in Milan, who was Ambrose. And Ambrose was a fellow, unlike many of the other people in Italy at that time, who knew Greek and who had read Origen and Plotinus. This has just recently been discovered that he knew Plotinus, because since the rediscovery of Plotinus in the 20th century, people have been discovering that there's all kinds of literal quotes from Plotinus in Ambrose. Anyhow, he was so impressed, Augustine, by the preaching of Ambrose, at first simply by his rhetoric, you know, he appreciated, you know, the way he could handle language, that he stayed on, and after a while, it was via the Neoplatonic way in which Ambrose presented the gospel, which Ambrose had gotten from Origen and from Plotinus, that Augustine became interested in the Christian faith. And he tells us in the Confessions that at this stage of his approaching Christianity, some Platonic books fell into his hands, and it's pretty well been proved beyond doubt that these Platonic books were a Latin translation of Plotinus' works, the Enneads, that he read these works of Plotinus, and that this, the combination of Ambrose's preaching and the reading of Plotinus' Enneads, were the decisive factors in his deciding to be baptized into the Christian faith. And the fact that this is so has led a number of scholars, in fact, the first guy that proposed this theory was our friend Adolf von Harnack, to suggest that when Augustine was, quote, converted, he was not, in a real sense, converted to Christianity in the first instance, but to Neoplatonism. So there's been a hot controversy between the followers of von Harnack and especially Catholic scholars, because Catholic scholars pretty well dominate the field of patristic studies, which is a great pity, which is why some of you people should go up to the Institute and learn about patristics and get a Protestant view of the matter. There's been a hot controversy about whether Augustine was in fact converted to Christianity at that time in Milan. Nobody doubts that later in his life he became an Orthodox Christian, but the question is whether he really understood what Christianity was about at that stage and whether he didn't really have a very Neoplatonic concept of what Christianity was. Because he himself says in his Confessions, that's his autobiography, you know, where he tells the story of his intellectual development, he says that what really was the decisive factor in his coming to Christianity was that Ambrose and the reading of these Platonic books convinced him that it was possible for there to be a non-material human reality. The Manichaeans had said, you know, man is completely material, he's caught up in this world, and what he's got to do is get out of it. And the Neoplatonists had this heavy emphasis on, you know, the reality of the soul and the reality of the intellect, which was all immaterial, and in which man could participate. So he himself, Augustine himself, says in so many words that it was through this Neoplatonic distinction that he finally got into the Christian faith. And it's interesting that while he was up in Milan, he before he was baptized, he had to go into some catechism. You know, a person was not baptized, you know, as today, until he had some basic instruction in the Christian faith. So that what he did, he took a few of his friends, plus his mother, Monica, who had been praying very hard for him all along that he would become Christian. He and his friends and his mother went up to an estate up in the foothills of the Alps, or anyhow, the hill country up by the North Italian lakes, a place called Casiciacum. I guess it's about 30 miles north of Milan, which in the, I could maybe, as an aside, say that today, this place is called Casago, and if you're ever in North Italy, you can visit it. I went up there about 2 years ago just for the sake of being where Augustine had been at that time. What he did there on this estate was talked about questions of faith and philosophy with his friends, and he wrote it up in the form of philosophical dialogues. And if you see the works of, you know, of Augustine in a library, you'll see that the first volume or two are called the Casiciacum Dialogues. And it is in those dialogues that you can see very clearly his the Neoplatonic influence. One of the writings, for instance, is called De Ordine, on order, in which he explains evil as a lack of order. And he also goes into the whole metaphysical theory of Neoplatonism, that you can reduce that in turn to a lack of being. So all of this is you know, very clearly Neoplatonic. He tells us this in his Confessions. And just before he died, Augustine, he wrote a book called retractions, which does not, well, the Latin title is retractationes, which is generally translated retractions, but it doesn't really mean that he, you know, took back what he had said. Well, what it really means is he took made a review of all his writings to date. And then when he, in his old age, you know, looks back on his intellectual development, he says about those early dialogues that he had written before he was baptized, "I was far too much influenced by the pagan philosophers. A lot of that stuff should, you know, would have to be rewritten." And, you know, he says that he moved slowly farther and farther away from that influence, which is important to note, because when people quote Augustine, you should always be aware of what stage of Augustine's development that work is. Because if it's an early book, you know, people can prove a lot of Neoplatonic doctrine out of that. If it's a late work, you can prove the opposite very often. So the history of Augustine's life is really, after becoming a Christian, is of moving away from this Neoplatonic influence. But nevertheless, it was very decisively there, and especially in such doctrines as, you know, what is sin, you know, is a lack of being, a lack of good, and so on, which is a metaphysical doctrine of sin, which completely lacks the moral dimension and is therefore rather bad. Okay, so that's just an illustration of the influence of Neoplatonism on the patristics. I should tell you one last anecdote about Augustine, and that is that on his deathbed, this is kind of a dramatic situation, the Roman Empire was crumbling at this time. He died in 430, and the Goths, I think it was the Goths or else the Huns, anyhow, some barbaric Germanic tribe, had come down from what's today Germany, all the way down Italy, and had ravished the countryside, had taken over all the Roman institutions, and had crossed the Mediterranean over into North Africa, where Augustine was, and had besieged the city of which he was a bishop, Hippo, as he lay dying. He was on his deathbed when the whole Roman civilization was crashing around his ears, so to speak, and the Goths were besieging the city where he was, and it was only a question of time before they took the place over and everybody would be killed. So, in that situation, his last recorded words on his deathbed are, you would think perhaps, a quote from the Bible, but they are a direct quote from Enneads 4:5, a quote from Plotinus, and he says, "It is not the part of a wise man to think that is any great thing if a mortal man dies." So he's saying, you know, so man dies, you know, it's no big deal if I die because I'm immortal anyhow. Right? And it's a wordplay. That's why he probably liked it, because he was a rhetor. In Latin, it's, as in the original Greek, it's a wordplay between death and mortal, because mortal is Latin for dying. So anyhow, so you can see what a pervasive influence Plotinus had on Augustine, you know, right to the very end. That's just as an illustration of the importance of Neoplatonism. Now, I should bring up one other thing which has been of great importance in the history of Christian thinking. I'll have to do that in 5 minutes, I see. I will deal very briefly with the figure of Dionysius, the pseudo-Areopagite. Now, there is a title for you. You people may remember that in Acts 17, the story is told of how Paul preaches to the philosophers in Athens, and he talks to the Areopagus or to the Areopagus. It was a hill near the Agora in Athens. And there was also a council called by that name, so it's not sure whether it was only on the hill or also to the council that he spoke. But anyhow, Luke tells us in Acts that there were philosophers among them, and that they listened to him for a while, but when he talked about the resurrection of the dead, they laughed him out of court. They said, you know, this guy, you know, this is obvious idiocy. And I think it's always interesting in 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about how he first came to the Corinthians. After being laughed out of court in Athens, he goes to Corinth. And he says to the Corinthians, you know, you knew how I was when I first came to Corinth. I was trembling with fear. And I lost all my confidence. Because he'd just been laughed out of court by the fellows in Athens. And then he says, you know, but I came to you in the power of the Spirit and the demonstration of the power of the Spirit. But anyhow, he was not completely without success in Athens. Luke tells us that one of the people that did receive the word of God was a man by the name of Dionysius the Areopagite, a member of this council called Areopagus. Now, so we know that there was a Christian who was converted by Paul, who was presumably rather philosophically inclined, since he was in this gathering of philosophers, and that he was Dionysius the Areopagite. Now, we don't hear anything of any Dionysius the Areopagite until the 6th century after Christ, and then suddenly a great body of literature becomes known, written by someone who purports to be Dionysius the Areopagite. I'm going to have to be very fast now. I'll say briefly what I'm saying. This Dionysius was in fact a hoax. His teacher had been not Paul the Apostle, but Proclus, a Neoplatonic philosopher, and his writings are just Neoplatonic philosophy dressed in biblical imagery. He is one of the few Greek fathers who was translated into Latin, and because it was believed right through the Middle Ages that he was not a hoax, but that he was the genuine disciple of Paul, his writings had an almost canonical authority, so that Thomas Aquinas, for instance, quotes Dionysius the Areopagite almost as often as he quotes Augustine, which is quite a lot. So that both via Augustine, who wrote Latin, and via Dionysius the Pseudo Areopagite, who was translated, one of the few Greek authors who was translated into Latin, the Neoplatonic influence got into the Middle Age, the medieval tradition, especially fellows like Aquinas, and became all wrapped up in the Christian intellectual tradition. And it was not until the Renaissance, when people began to learn, critical literary analysis, that it was discovered that it was in fact impossible that this fellow could have lived in the first century after Christ, and that it was a hoax. And until the 20th century, there are Catholic thinkers who defend the authenticity of this Areopagite, which is really Neoplatonism, but because of this big mistake, had gotten confused with this apostolic authority. So that it's important here again to realize the pervasive influence of Neoplatonism on modern Christian thought.
To continue, go to the next tape in this series.
If you would like more information about Ligonier Ministries or about our audio and video tapes, call us toll-free at 1-800-435-4343. In Florida, call area code 305-834-1633 or write us at P.O. Box 7500, Orlando, Florida 32854.